We have a lot of fascinating ground to cover today. And one way of getting into it is to indicate the way in which these media always have with them a hidden ground. Any good joke has as a basis of it a grievance, some abrasive situation which the joke titillates or eases. And I'm going to illustrate this from a couple of little anecdotes. There's the one about the mother who is trying to get her son to go to school. And she says, "Son, it is time to get up and go to school." And son says, "Mom, I'm not going to school anymore. They hate me, they laugh at me, they throw things at me, and you just give me two reasons why I should go to school again." And she said, "Well, son, the first reason is you're 43 years old. The second reason is you're the principal." I asked a friend of mine who was going to Moscow a few weeks ago to a science congress to bring me back a Russian joke, one that they actually tell in Moscow. And he brought me back two or three, and I'll give you one of them. It's about an attempt to set up a Russian nightclub, Hollywood style or American style. And it flopped, and they had an investigation. And the committee wanted to know what about the food. And they were told that they had a French cuisine with French wines and good prices. And how about the decor, the layout? We had Italian designers with Hollywood consultants. And how about the entertainment? Super, they said. All the girls were members of the party since 1915. You can see the grievances, they peep out from different angles in the different stories. But there is a hidden factor in any joke. There has to be this hidden factor. And I'm going to show that in any of the media, likewise, there's always a big hidden ground that is usually concealed by the program. The hidden ground as a factor in all media, all technologies, it perhaps can be made very plain by the motor car. The motor car in North America has a very strange function. It is used for privacy, not so much for transportation as for privacy. Now, the hidden ground behind this peculiar use of the car is that North Americans go outside, typically, to be alone and go inside or go home to be social. The rest of mankind go outside to be social and home to be private and alone. Since there is no privacy in the American home, the motor car takes up that role. It must therefore be big and quiet. Motor cars of the European car, the Japanese car, small and noisy. But this is an example of, in my opinion, of a kind of hidden ground behind the motor car. Why do Americans go outside to be alone, unlike other people? That is a pretty tough question. But as far as I've been able to determine, it relates to the fact that 200 years ago or more, our people came to this continent to fight nature, to tame the wilderness, and to subdue the elements. And so this typically led them out of doors to a kind of aggressive action against the environment. The environment was the enemy. It had to be subdued, tamed. This developed a habit of going outside aggressively and extrovertedly to fight. You'll find this peculiar pattern in all American literature, whether it's Thoreau or Melville or Henry James. And that the characters in these books are loners who are in quest of some hidden factor in their lives. And this is a theme which I wish to relate to the media. For example, most of our media are electronic now, and at the speed of light, or at electric speed, they tend to create mythic forms in all our institutions. At the speed of light, or at very high speed, ordinary events tend to acquire a mythic dimension, because myth is a compression, intense compression of long stretched out processes of development reduced to a very short scope. When you read, for example, that King Cadmus sowed the dragon's teeth and they sprang up armed men, you are reading a mythic statement or a legendary statement of the effects of the alphabet on Greek society. The alphabet, devised by Phoenician traders and businessmen, was used by the Greeks to translate Homer into a visual form and to bring the tribal encyclopedia under the control of literacy, and to, in other words, replace Homer with Plato. The pre-Socratics were pushed out, and logicians like Parmenides and Socrates came in. Now, one of the peculiar effects of the alphabet was to separate the visual faculty, the visual senses, from the other senses. The phonetic alphabet is the only alphabet in the world, or only form of writing in the world, that has this effect. Such an effect never occurred in China or in the Arab world or any other part of the world. Only the phonetic alphabet has this power to divorce the visual faculty from the other senses. And this made possible, at the same moment, Euclid and logicians and analysts and classifiers and the whole of the individualist pattern of Greek life. The alphabet made possible, at the moment that it separated the visual faculty from the other senses, it made possible Euclid and lineality. And Euclid revealed that visual space is continuous and connected and homogeneous and static. All the other spaces created by the other senses of touch and acoustics and kinesthesia, all these other senses are discontinuous, resonant, and dynamic. They're not static. There was a little boy on his first airplane ride, and he said to his daddy after they went up, "Daddy, when do we start to get smaller?" And it's an interesting question. Since the airplane gets smaller, why don't the people inside get smaller? And this relates to Euclid. An enclosed space is visual, is static. It cannot change. Now, if there were no canopy on the airplane, if it were an open cockpit plane, the people in the plane get smaller as the plane goes up. Parachutists say that at the moment they jump out of the plane, they're about 1 inch high. But when you're in an enclosed space, you remain static. This is visual. This is a peculiar property of the visual space when isolated from the other senses, that it becomes static. Now, this refers to many of the characteristics we associate with civilization. The alphabet, in divorcing the heart, the right hemisphere, from the head, the left hemisphere, the quantifying visual, detached, observant function. The alphabet, in doing that, left the other side of the brain somewhat in abeyance. The Greeks developed an environment of services and roads and military activities. Alexander the Great would have been quite unthinkable without the alphabet and without the lineality that went with it. And the Romans took over from there and developed an even more lineal and bureaucratically hierarchic structure. The courier systems and the military world of the Greeks and the Romans provided an environment which pushed the left hemisphere up into dominance, a dominance which it retained all through the Middle Ages and through the Renaissance, and reaching very high peaks with industrial assembly line and other structures of the lineal kind. Of course, at the speed of light, the environment that supported the left hemisphere suddenly is challenged. From the telegraph onward, the instantaneous character of the environment of information tends to push the right hemisphere up, up. A simultaneous environment, unheard of before electricity in the world, a simultaneous environment reactivates and gives dominance to the right hemisphere. The right hemisphere is characterized by intuitive, holistic, or totalitarian, and simultaneous awareness. For example, you cannot recognize a human countenance with the left hemisphere. You have to use the right hemisphere, or the functions of the right hemisphere, to have pattern recognition of complex structures. Complex structures, like the human face, can only be recognized by the right hemisphere. There's the case of a recent case of a Chinese who was completely paralyzed on his left hemisphere by a stroke, which in no way affected his speech or writing in Chinese. Chinese writing and speech does not depend upon any lineality or sequentiality or any of the characteristics of the left hemisphere. The same is true to various degrees of most of the third world. The third world is a right hemisphere world. Now, these hemispheres are empirically established. They are not theoretical in the usual sense of the word. They are discovered by brain surgeons in the course of repairing brain damage. And they have gradually spotted these functions as a result of their being impaired or dysfunctional. Now, the two hemispheres relate to the right and left hand. Handedness relates to the hemispheres. The left hemisphere controls right hand, and typically, and the right hemisphere controls left hand, typically. But that doesn't mean that a left-handed person is minus any access to the left hemisphere, nor vice versa. The two hemispheres are related by a large nervous structure called the corpus callosum, which is on top of the brain. This is a kind of interchange area where it is possible for dialogue to go on between the two hemispheres, and they should be and tend to be in a state of dialogue with each other. It simply happens that in an extreme culture like our first world literate culture, based upon an extreme use of lineality and for quantifying and measuring and expanding services at a very high speed, that extreme use is what gives the chart its significance. Because at the peak performance of the first world, industrially and so on, the right hemisphere has a very small function to perform. The left hemisphere tends to be in charge of education. All IQ testing is left hemisphere. Nobody has ever devised an IQ test for the right hemisphere. The very nature of IQ testing is quantified and therefore alien to the right hemisphere. The right hemisphere is designated by quality and the left by quantity. The left hemisphere by eye, the right hemisphere by ear. The ear hears from all directions at once and therefore is simultaneous. The eye does not see from all directions at once. Now, the ear creates a kind of acoustic space by the factor of simultaneity. And someone, I think it was Proclus, defined God as that being whose center is everywhere and whose margin is nowhere, which some psychologists designate as the nature of acoustic space. Acoustic space, that space in which the center is everywhere and the margin nowhere. It reminds me of a little item in Mr. Eliot's criticism, in which he is discussing the auditory imagination. It's in his essay on Matthew Arnold in The Uses of Poetry and Criticism. What I call the auditory imagination is the feeling for syllable and rhythm penetrating far below the conscious levels of thought and feeling, invigorating every word, sinking to the most primitive and forgotten, seeking the beginning and the end. It works through meanings, certainly not without meanings in the ordinary sense, and fuses the old and obliterated, the trite and the current, the new and the surprising, the most ancient and the most civilized mentality. A simultaneous structure, the auditory imagination. Eliot is famous also for his remark that all art from Homer to the present forms a simultaneous order, another acoustic image. All art from Homer to the present is simultaneous, it's all here, and the advent of any new kind of art modifies the entire structure. The same is true of any musical structure. The advent of any new note, any new phrase, any new rhythm modifies the entire structure. I think the same is true of all of our technology, since all of them are extensions of our own bodies, and therefore any innovation in technology modifies our relation to ourselves and to our bodies. This kind of homeostasis or equilibrium among the senses and among the technologies has led some people to entertain the idea of an ecology of media, a way of arranging the media so that they orchestrate instead of clashing with each other. Another peculiarity of moving at the speed of electricity or light is the tendency to become disembodied. When you are on the telephone or on the air, you do not have a physical body. You have an image, but no body. And this, too, is a unique development in human history. A discarnate man, the nuclear or electronic man, angelic and even super angelic in many respects, since angels have no capacity to be in more than one place at a time, whereas on the air or on the phone you can be in many places at the same time. Kenneth Stamp has a book called The Causes of the American Civil War, and on page one announces that according to all latest historical conjecture and observation, no cause for the American Civil War is known. I recommend you have a look at that book. It's a strange book. It's a series of people contributing. There's an anthropologist who points out that had there had been no blacks in the South, the war would have taken place anyway. They had nothing to do with the war. This relates now to the matter of separatism and the tendency to decentralize under electric conditions. Today, separatism, whether psychic or social, private or corporate, separatism is a very familiar experience. And when Quebec began its attempts at separatism, I looked up the history of the American Civil War on this very point to find out why did the South want out of the Union. And that's why I was somewhat staggered to discover that historians are unable to announce or to pronounce any particular reason. They think it's just very bad luck. Some very miserable set of circumstances took place, but that nothing was gained by the Civil War by anybody. However, the same could be said about Quebec today. On the other hand, one very obvious feature both about Quebec and about the American South is that they are both oral cultures and in a state of very uneasy alliance with the left hemisphere culture of the North on the one hand and of English Canada on the other. English Canada is the left hemisphere part of the world, and Quebec is right hemisphere. Quebec is oral, like the Irish. The Irish and the English. The Irish are a very acoustic culture and very ill at ease with the highly quantified materialistic English and have been struggling with them for many centuries. The South was an acoustic area, still is. That's where all the jazz and rock come from. Jazz and rock are acoustic events which cannot take place in or cannot originate in non-acoustic or non-oral cultures. It's a strange matter which has not really been studied, but the fact that all jazz and rock come out of the oral culture of the South with its strange Elizabethan language and traditions of speech is certainly worth studying in our TV age. The oral cultures tend to be group-oriented as compared with the highly individualistic orientation of the left hemisphere and visual cultures. In the period of the Civil War, the big electric event that was dawning on the world was the telegraph. The telegraph had become commercial by about 1840 and had a profound effect on news gathering and news reporting, and may well have been one of the causes of awakening Southern impulses by resonance at this simultaneous acoustic kind. One of the peculiar results of the telegraph was that it was simultaneous with the development of symbolism, which is a figure ground pattern problem. And Edgar Allan Poe, one of the key figures in the origins of symbolism and of great influence on Baudelaire and Europe, was very much aware of the technology of his time. In fact, in his famous story of the Maelstrom, he insisted that art made possible survival by pattern recognition. In the story of the Maelstrom, his sailor caught in a great whirlpool while out fishing began to study this vast thing in which he was caught, and he noticed that some things disappeared downward and other things reappeared and came up. And he attached himself to one of these reappearing objects and survived. And this is the allegory that Poe presents to the world of the function of art in society, the function of pattern recognition, and the function of anticipating effects with causes. Poe invented the detective story, and as well as symbolism, and I think the two are related, because the detective story is a form in which the figure and the ground are deeply interrelated, and the detective typically studies the hidden ground rather than the isolated figure. The figure of the corpse or the victim, he relates to a hidden ground of events which in turn illuminate the figure. Kierkegaard, also very conscious of the telegraph as a revolution in his time, Kierkegaard rebelled against the Cartesian lineality of the philosophers of his time and against Hegel. Discontinuity is acoustic. Continuity, connectedness, is visual and left hemisphere. Discontinuity, which is electric, electric currents do not flow in the way that water does through a pipe or a wire. That is not the form in which they exist. And the telegraph had not been around very long before we had a revolution in physics. Max Planck in 1900 came up with the new model of awareness of matter as discontinuous quanta of energy. Matter was not, in his idea, connected at all. There were rather resonating intervals in matter, or among these quanta. In the same year that Planck came forward with his quantum theory, Freud came forward with his discontinuity between consciousness and the unconscious. And in the same year, Picasso, with his discontinuous spaces called cubism, later called cubism, originally called multifaceted space. And of course, Einstein pushed that on into relating the form and structure of things to the speed of light. Relativity theory refers to the fact that if you are to measure anything in this world, you have to measure it against the speed of light. Stein, and then, of course, many others, Wyndham Lewis, Joyce Pound, Eliot, all moved into this new symbolist world of discontinuity. In 1957, the Sputnik was pushed into orbit and created a new environment for the planet. The planet went inside this man-made environment for the first time. And in a certain sense, that ended nature. The Greeks had invented nature by classifying various phenomena visually, and with the resonating simultaneous environment of information via Sputnik, Greek nature disappeared. When we experience or are submitted to the situation of disembodiment, a discarnate, non-physical existence, we lose touch with natural law. Disembodied man, discarnate man, cannot relate to natural law. One of the peculiarities, therefore, of this discarnate condition is the kind of moral anarchy that descends upon people. The old moral codes, based upon hierarchic knowledge of nature and society, tend to be scrapped or just to fade away. We have seen a vast amount of this in our own time. I'm going to draw attention to another aspect of radio and the simultaneous world, one that has not, I think, been looked into very much, if at all. And that is in the jazz age, which is also the age of prohibition, the panic about booze probably related to the advent of radio. Why? Well, tribal people, acoustic people, right hemisphere people, cannot use alcohol. I suggest, therefore, that the radio age, the prohibition age, may have had an instinctive panic about the danger of alcohol, just as the TV age has an instinctive panic about drugs. Television is a very powerful drug. It is an inner trip, a psychedelic inner trip. And it is addictive. And drugs are not new, but the panic about drugs is new. In the 1920s, booze, there was no more booze than there ever had been, but the panic was new. One of the peculiarities of television as an experience is that it immobilizes the motor muscles of the eyes. This is one of the reasons for sleepiness in the presence of TV. And its soporific qualities are related to this fact that the motor muscles do not respond to the flow. You are the screen in television, you're not the camera. You are the screen. The energy flows into you and into your eyes. And the energy flows so quickly, in milliseconds, that the eyes do not have any opportunity to respond by muscular movement. It's quite different with film. With 24 frames a second, the eyes do have an opportunity to respond muscularly, but not with TV. And so, one of the peculiar problems of TV, and it's as natural as the effects of, say, radioactivity on people who don't know the properties of radioactive material. One of the problems of TV, therefore, is in immobilizing the eye muscles, it makes reading very difficult. The TV child who is negligently exposed to large quantities of television has trouble concentrating and moving his eye muscles. There are fortunately people who know the kinds of exercises necessary to correct this physical defect resulting from TV viewing. There are specific exercises. One of the most effective exercises against this immobilizing is the trampoline, because the trampoline permits the eye and the head and all the muscles of the body to exercise in a variety of patterns. Another strange sidelight on this matter is the fact that learning disabilities are 90% male and only 10%, if that, female. Why should television have this adverse effect mainly on males, boys? Well, the answer there is not too hard either. Because girls have a series of exercises and connected anywhere from skipping to sewing to cooking to cosmetics, a series of exercises which require rather delicate muscular adjustments, whereas hockey sticks and baseball bats are not much help in energizing the motor muscles of the eyes. And so the boys' physical exercise life is rather unable to help him to correct the effects of television. Now, I thought that by bringing radio and TV together in this matter, it might throw a little more light from one to the other, just as these two hemispheres act reciprocally as figure and ground. When one is figure, the other is ground. When one is ground, the other is figure. And this interplay between media helps one to understand. But boys who find their IQ ratings way below the girls find their ratings in the class room very adverse, naturally tend to get pretty mad, because it has nothing to do with intelligence. You can have 20/20 vision in each eye and still be profoundly dyslexic, because dyslexia is not something that takes place in the eyes. It takes place in the matter of convergence of the eyes in front of the page. Dyslexia is a problem of convergence and has nothing to do with vision. Violence, by the way, in that regard, is the natural response of somebody who has lost his identity. When people lose their image of themselves and their identities, they become very angry, very disturbed, and very violent. The violence of this generation is, I think, prompted by loss of identity. Loss of identity is something that took place with radio. You'll find that the poets and the artists of the radio age were quite aware of this. Mr. Eliot's Hollow Men is an account of loss of identity, so with The Wasteland and his other poetry. In the case of Finnegan's Wake and of Joyce knew very well. He called, by the way, these two things the ineluctable modality of the visible, ineluctable modality of the audible. Finnegan's Wake is a full recognition of the return of Western man to the right hemisphere. Finn again, back to the Finn cycle, back to acoustic culture, our tribal man. But this violence is everywhere in our entertainment, and I don't think that violence in entertainment should be taken as literally a consumer item. It has a hidden ground, again, of loss of identity. For example, in the typical Western movie, our famous genre of violence, in the typical Western, the people on the frontier are people without identity. When people went out west to the frontier, they automatically became nobodies. They began to fight to prove that they were somebody. The violent man is typically in quest of who am I? What am I? Even the Son of Sam and his ilk belong in this category of people who have had their identities scrubbed right off and are struggling wildly and savagely for revenge and recovery of identity. Just why people crave this identity, it's hard to say, but look at the recent program Roots, in which group people, black people, are seeking their original identities in Africa, not private identity at all, but group identity. Loss of group identity can lead to violence just as much as loss of private identity. We're in the Western, or in the first world, we're more inclined to be conscious of the loss of private identity. And in other parts of the world, they're more conscious of loss of group identity, loss of face. The American South lost face in the Civil War. Any the Germans lost face in the First and Second Wars. This always breeds the danger of reprisal and the desire for recovery of identity. It would help, surely, if we knew that violence was motivated by the quest for identity. We might then learn how to head off some of its effects and how to compensate for some of the loss. A recent report from Colorado indicated that 99% of all men behind bars in Colorado are dyslexic cases. That is, people with learning difficulties. The number of inmates of penitentiaries who are merely dyslexic is fantastic. Nothing to do with morals. A physical handicap like paraplegic or other. When Rodin was completing his statue of the thinker on a very hot afternoon, he finally turned to the model, the sitter, and said, "Okay, stupid, you can get down now." I feel somewhat sympathy with that man. I'm going to climb down. A captain of a big Lufthansa liner approaching Buenos Aires turned on the intercom and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I have very bad news. We're out of gas. I'm going to ditch the plane right here." Now, to the swimmers, I say, swim straight ahead. It's only 12 miles. Follow the sun. And to the non-swimmers, I say, thank you for flying Lufthansa. Thank you.